And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Yes, we're back. And welcome, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into the Apologetic Zone and the Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I am your host and, I guess you could say, sensei, Gary Matuta. Welcome you back for yet another adventure into learning more about the faith, loving the faith, sharing the faith, and got a great show in store for you today. Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley is going to join us to talk about, well, let's see, basically about how do you lay down the foundations for discussions about the faith. Many times you sit across the coffee table with your friends and you realize that maybe the playing surface isn't even. You know, maybe there is some groundwork that needs to be done before you even start broaching important topics about God's existence, the divinity of Christ, things like that, the truth of the church. So we're just going to talk about basically leveling the playing field, laying the foundations for good discussions. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you remember last time Kenneth was on the show, he's just a wealth of information. And so I look forward to having him back on. He's going to be our guest sensei right after the first break. And also, I want to give my shout-outs to all those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Ah, yes, look at all the emojis. Oh, yes, great. Great to see you back. Lots of familiar names. And my favorite part of the program. So you are also part of the program. If you're listening live, perhaps on radio, or who knows, maybe listen to podcasts. Of course, you can't call, but give us a call, 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. And I need to give my apologies for those who have sent emails to the Dojo mailbox, which, by the way, everybody, it's questions@handsonapologetics.com. Questions@handsonapologetics.com. Come straight to the Dojo. I try to read them. As you know, last week I was in California on the West Coast trip. We visited the world headquarters of Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Met all the great people who are involved with the program. It's a lot of fun, except for Jesse. Didn't see Jesse, but, you know, he's out of state. But I did sit in the patrol car and helped him with one of the Jesus 911 programs. But as you know, I was out giving the talk in Covina, California. But I'm trying to dig myself out of all the work that has piled up in my absence. So my apologies to those who sent emails. I promise I'll try to get to them as soon as I can. I did kind of look at a couple of them, and ladies and gentlemen, there's some great questions and comments in there that I think I definitely will bring up on the air. So be patient. You know, that's part of the dojo teaching. You got to be patient, trust in God, and God willing, I'll be able to get through all the email. And by the way, for those listening, maybe there is a program that you would like to listen again to, perhaps this program. When Ken Hensley joins us, realize that the Virgin Most Powerful Radio website has all these programs available in various formats. You could download them, you could share them, you could do all sorts of wonderful things with them. And what is that website? Well, it's www.virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Just go to the website, click on shows. You have all the shows Virgin Most Powerful produces available at a fingertip. You can click on Hands-On Apologetics, scroll down, pick your favorite show, listen to it live off the internet, download it, do whatever you'd like. And by the way, I haven't done this in a while, but please support Virgin Most Powerful Radio if you can. Certainly support us with your prayers. We need prayers always. You know, we're doing the Lord's work, and, you know, we plant, God willing, plant seeds, but we need prayers to cause the growth. Also, share us on social media. Let people know about us, because we're got some great programs on the show, but, you know, they can only do good if people know about them. So like us, share us, mention us on Facebook. Really appreciate it. And also, if you can, appreciate your generous financial contributions. Like I always say, you know, when you're doing the Lord's work, you still have to live in the world. You still have to pay bills. And I know with my ministry, I used to run a 401c3 ministry. Just a little bit more in donations can go a really long way. And so we could really kick up the production value and all the other stuff with just a little bit more money. So please, if you could, please become a monthly donor. We'd really appreciate it. All right. So in addition to our guest, we are going to do our exercises. Of course, we do a finding the fallacy. Every program we talk about a informal fallacy of one sort or another, just to sharpen our critical thinking skills. And also we introduce ourselves to Early Church Father. The finding the fallacy for today is the argument from moderation. And the Early Church Father today is Lactantius. So why don't we jump right into our exercises, because I want to get Ken on the air ASAP. So what is the finding of fallacy? The argument for moderation. Now, this informal fallacy asserts that something is true because it's a compromise between two opposite positions. So there's something about our culture that we often think that the moderate, the middle position, is always most preferable, right? And that's true for most things. If you're arguing about what's good and what's better, or what's better and what's best, sometimes the middle position is the preferable position because it has the less drawbacks, right? And also you tend to, people tend to look at moderates as somehow, you know, superior, peace-loving, that type of thing. But when it comes down to establishing a valid point, simply being a position between two opposites doesn't give it any special priority. For example, when you're asking a question about what's right and what's wrong, the middle position is only half wrong. You know, you want to have the right position. There's no benefit in being the compromise or the moderate position. So now don't get me wrong. Sometimes the correct position is the moderate position. That occurs lots of times with, especially in theology, where you might have two extremes and the orthodox position is the middle. But you can't argue because something's in the middle that it's most likely true. Okay. Because like I said, when it comes to the issues of right and wrong, true or false, there is no compromise. And so you can't argue, well, because it's the middle position, it most likely is true. So that is our finding the fallacy for today, the argument from moderation. All right. So keep that in mind. Especially, you know, it's used a lot in politics, you know, that type of stuff. There, by the way, is another propaganda technique that's similar to the argument from moderation, which is called grabbing the rhetorical middle. And if you have been listening to this program, you know, on Fridays, we usually go through propaganda techniques. You might remember the grabbing the rhetorical middle sounds a lot like the argument for moderation. Just FYI. Okay, let's go to meet the Early Church Father for today. The Early Church Father is Lactantius. Lactantius was born in Africa. He's North African born and a rhetorician by profession and also a convert. He's born roughly around the year 250 AD. Towards the end of the century, he was summoned by Diocletian to his new capital in Nicomedia in Bithynia to teach rhetoric. Being a Latin rhetorician, however, in this Greek city, had him not very busy. There wasn't a lot of pupils that wanted to learn rhetoric in Latin. So instead, he decided to start writing books. And around the year 303 AD, Lactantius became Christian. And as such, he was obliged by imperial decree of that year to resign his position as teacher. So roughly about 305 to 306, he left Bithynia, and the next time we hear about him was later in 317 AD, where he's already old and living in poverty. He's summoned by Emperor Constantine to be a private tutor to his son Crispus, and he finally dies roughly around 317 AD. Now, we do have some writings of him where he defends Christianity, the most important of which is a group of writings known as the Divine Institutions. The Divine Institutions are seven books that were written roughly between the years 304 and 310. And it kind of has a double purpose, the purpose of refuting paganism and setting up forth a case for true doctrine. Okay. Now, everybody agrees that Lactantius has his strong points and his weak points. He's a very polished writer, although not a very skilled apologist in his own right. Nevertheless, this is perhaps the first attempt to produce a summary, an exposition of Christian doctrine, which is pretty cool. So his writings are available, by the way, on the internet for free. You don't have to buy the books or anything, but he and also other church fathers are out there. And I invite you guys to read them. It's good stuff. Let's see. The one site I go to, just FYI, and there's many other sites that also have the early church fathers, but I love personally the newadvent.org website, which is run by the Knights of Columbus. But if you jump on that and click Fathers of the Church, you can read Lactantius and all the other early church fathers. And, you know, it's kind of fun. Lactantius, like I said, he's smooth and he doesn't pull punches. So he does get a little snarly here and there in his writings against the pagans. But fascinating things. All right. So anyway, on the other side of the break, we're going to talk to Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley about laying down a foundation for talking about matters of the faith. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
We're going to have our guest sensei up next, Ken Hensley. By the way, if you have any questions for Ken, give us a call, 888-526-2151. Ken Hensley has degrees in Bible and theology from Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. He served as an associate and senior pastor in Baptist Church. In September of 1996, Ken resigned the pastorate and entered into the church on Easter Vigil 1997 with his wife. He has co-authored the book The Godless Delusion, A Catholic Challenge to Modern Atheism, along with Patrick Madrid. And he also has a whole slew of some very good audio CD programs if you can get a hold of them. Ken Hensley, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hello, Gary. Good to hear your voice again. How you doing?
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Ken, you know, before we begin, I always ask my guests to give a short thumbnail sketch of kind of their journey of the faith. Would you mind real quick kind of summarizing, like, where you started off with and how you ended up in the church?
Sure. Well, you just did it, but I assume if you want a little bit more, I'll do what you did times three. Okay.
Okay.
Well, as you said, I was an ordained Baptist minister for about 11 years. And what happened was I found out that an old buddy of mine from seminary days had become Catholic. This buddy's name was Scott Hahn. You may have heard of him. And when I found out that he had become Catholic, I mean, someone just literally walked up to me at my church and gave me a set of tapes by Scott Hahn called Answering Common Objections Against the Catholic Faith, which, you know, blew my mind. I went home and listened to the tapes and got a hold of Scott and began to talk to him. I had never thought about Catholicism seriously before that night, and listening to Scott's conversion story, you know, intrigued me just enough to want to learn more. You know, I kind of thought to myself, how could I have gone this far in my education? And I can't really articulate the strong case that can be made for the Catholic faith. And so I was curious. I thought I could answer the things he said at the time, but I was curious. Anyway, this led to about 4 years of basically rethinking my whole Christian worldview from the ground floor up. And then I became Catholic. And since then, I mean, it's like been a Forrest Gump story. I've done everything but run back and forth across the United States and run a shrimp boat. But for 18 years, I've worked in the, you know, basically in phone sales as a headhunter and then as a stockbroker. I waited tables as well in there. But anyway, the last few years now, I've been working for the Coming Home Network that was begun by Marcus Grody, another convert to the Catholic faith, who was previously a Presbyterian minister, and he hosts the show that's on EWTN called The Journey Home. Anyway, I got to talking with Marcus and with his son and with other people, and they brought me on staff about 3 years ago now. So now I work full-time for the Coming Home Network. I basically help people become Catholic all day long. That's what I do. Part of that is writing. And so I do regularly blog for the Coming Home Network, and it's on their blog page at chnetwork.org, if anybody wants to go there. And recently, I wrote a series of 13 parts, 13 articles, describing how I evangelize those who doubt or deny the existence of God. And this is what you you said you want to talk to me about, and that we might actually do this as a series. We might kind of go through the series over the next while. But anyway, that's not what you asked me, so that's my basic story.
And you're sticking to it, right?
Yeah, I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, and that's great. And those articles are available on chnetwork.org, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so folks, if you're listening and maybe you're in the car and you missed part of the program or something cited, you know that the materials there in written form on chnetwork.org, so you can check it out. So, Ken, you know, whenever I'm face-to-face with an unbeliever, I don't know about you, but I always feel like I'm behind the eight ball, that somehow, you know, I'm starting at a deficit or a handicap, you know, that they have the playing field.
Yes.
Is that true, or is that just a misperception?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that you ask the question that way, because to some degree, it may be our perception, because we know that we hold a view that is more and more challenged in popular culture now, especially among young people, you know, that have picked up one of Richard Dawkins' books or Daniel Dennett or Sam Harris. And now they think they're geniuses and they know that there's no God and all that. But right. But I do think that there's a deeper reason, and that is the assumption now in our society, in our culture, and it's come from a lot of different, you know, the scientism of the last several hundred years building up and whatnot. The assumption really is that the natural world is all that exists. And if you want to argue that anything exists beyond that, then you are behind the eight ball. You know, the onus is entirely on you. The assumption is that nothing exists but the natural world. And so I do feel that. In fact, if you read atheists, they often will say things like, I have nothing to defend. You know, I simply do not accept the existence of God, but I'm not defending anything in particular, and therefore I have no burden of proof. You're the one saying that God exists, and so the burden of proof is entirely on you. And I want to say one thing about that. It's true that in debate, as in a courtroom, the one who is making the positive assertion does bear the burden of proof, so that's true. But what is not true is that most atheists are not making a positive assertion. This is part of the kind of foundation from which I move and I think. Most atheists are making a positive assertion about the nature of the world. When they say, obviously, when they say nature is all that there is, they're making a positive assertion. And so I don't think it's entirely free that so many atheists sort of take the attitude that they can lean up against the brick wall, you know, and smoke a cigarette and say, you know, yeah, you give me your arguments and I'm just going to listen. And then they can just shoot them down one by one. Oh, that's not good enough. I don't accept that. Or that doesn't prove anything. Try again. Right. With this feeling that they have nothing to argue or nothing to support, nothing to defend. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah. So you wouldn't accept them saying that it's not that they have a belief, but it's an absence of belief. And so
no,
there's no assertion whatsoever. It's just like a non-assertion.
Well, I mean, it is true that they have an absence of belief in God, but it's not true that they're making no assertion.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's fair to challenge their assertion in, right. you know, in whatever ways are reasonable.
Yeah, right. Because that you have to prove that it's only nature that, it, you know, that exists. I mean, we all agree nature exists and nature is true. But how in the world do you come up with this idea that it's limited only to nature and there's nothing beyond it?
Well, I think that they might say, well, open your eyes and you see nature, you know, you don't see anything else. And so again, the burden of proof is on you. And I want to back up a step and I want to say that, okay. Yes, we do have a burden of proof. And I support theistic apologetics and I support the classical arguments for the existence of God, which is not what I'm arguing in this series. I'm doing something different, but I, you know, I think that Edward Fazer is probably one of the best voices doing that now. Yep. And anybody who wants to listen to the interview that he did with Ben Shapiro, I think that you can find it on YouTube. I think Ed did a great job of presenting the basic classical, you know, Thomas Aquinas arguments for the existence of God. So I do think we have a burden of proof. I'm just saying that I do not accept the idea that the onus is entirely on me and that the atheist can just stand back and has nothing to say or nothing to defend. There are ways of challenging his naturalist worldview, and that's what I'm bringing out in this series.
Yeah, and you title it Wizard of Oz Apologetics, which, of course, yeah. harkens back to my favorite scene in The Wizard of Oz where he says, ignore the man behind the curtain, right?
Yeah. I titled part one. Again, the series is How I Evangelize Those Who Doubt or Deny the Existence of God. And it's in 13 parts. It can be found on by searching back through the blog page on the chnetwork.org website. And it's posted on the God page on the site, too. But anyway, part one, I title it Wizard of Oz Apologetics, because this is sort of the approach that I like to take. And that is to you know, they went up and they pulled back the curtain. And when they pulled back the curtain, then the wizard didn't look the way that he had he had sounded like right. a big deal, right? And when they pulled back the curtain, it's this little guy sitting there, you know, and he suddenly shrinks. Well, in the same way, you know, I think that it's easy for the atheist to say, oh, nature is all that exists. But if you begin to challenge him, then it's like pulling back the curtain. When you begin to challenge him, then it's another matter. And atheists understand that there's a challenge to be made. Let me read to you a short quotation from John Searle. He's an atheist philosopher, okay. Well-known atheist philosopher. He's professor of the philosophy of mind at UC Berkeley. This is what he has written. He's an atheist. There is exactly one overriding question in contemporary philosophy. Okay, one overriding question. Okay, what is it? How do we fit in? How can we square this self-conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational agents? How do we square this with a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles? So here's an atheist saying, okay, I'm an atheist. Okay, we're atheists. We believe that nothing exists but particles, meaningless, mindless, unfree, you know, mechanistic, deterministic, non-rational, brute physical particles. And then he says, yeah. But once we've said that we believe this, think of the question that emerges. In fact, he says it's the overriding question in all of contemporary philosophy. How do we fit in then? How do we fit in? We conceive of ourselves as moral beings, and yet we read Richard Dawkins, who says that this universe is a universe in which right and wrong do not exist. He says, John Searle says, we conceive of ourselves as rational beings. Well, how does that fit in a universe that is completely non-rational? I mean, we say that we believe in a universe in which nothing exists. I mean, nothing, you know, with all capital letters, nothing exists but physical particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws. And yet we want to say, on the other hand, that we are rational and that reason means something, or that reason exists, that rationality exists. We believe that there's meaning in our lives. Well, how does that square with a universe that is entirely meaningless? So what I do in apologetics, really, and we're going to begin to illustrate this more when you and I talk again, if we continue doing this once a month or whatever it is, I'll dig more into the illustrations. But that's the basic approach that I'm taking, is to say to the atheist, okay, so you believe that nothing exists but the material universe? Then what about this? What about that? What I want to do is I want to challenge the atheist to account for himself, to account for the richness of human nature and human life on the basis of what he is claiming is true of the universe in which we exist. And that right. takes a lot of form, which I won't go into right now. But that's what I mean by the Wizard of Oz.
Very good. Well, we're talking with Ken Hensley about laying a foundation for talking about belief. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley about basically evening the playing field, I guess, when you're talking to non-believers. And Kenneth just quoted this incredible quote from John Cyril, where he admits that the one overriding question in contemporary philosophy is, how do we square our own experience with this purely naturalistic view that the world's mindless, meaningless, unfree, rational? So in a sense, Ken, he's kind of saying that if all that exists is nature, then it's kind of, we are kind of square pegs trying to fit into a round hole.
Yeah, that's very well said. I was I laughed when you called me Master Apologist, because it reminds me of something many years ago when I was teaching a college class at a Bible study in my home when I was a pastor. Someone asked me a hard question, and I said, how do I know? I don't know the answer. I said, what do you think I am, the master teacher of the universe? And they cracked up, and someone made a T-shirt for me that said Master Teacher of the Universe on it, and I wore it for years. So,
oh wow.
Anyway, I'm not a master apologist. I'm just someone trying to figure this stuff out as I go along. But yeah, you're exactly right that it's like trying to put a square peg into a round hole. Now, I want to get into the background a little bit if I can. There is a background in my mind to taking this approach in apologetics, because it's a different kind of approach. You know, rather than saying, okay, I'm going to present you now with a proof for God's existence and coming out with one of Aquinas' five ways or something like that. Here's the background to it. It's a biblical background, and it's this. The Bible teaches me certain things about this human person who's sitting in front of me, regardless of whether he or she, regardless of what he or she believes about the nature of reality. You know, my friend, again, says that he's an atheist. You know, he says that he believes that nothing exists but the natural world. But the Bible tells me certain things about him. My Catholic faith tells me certain things about him that I believe. And the first of them is this. Scripture teaches me that all of creation gives evidence of God's existence. Correct?
Yep. Amen.
I think of Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. The Bible says that all of creation, as it were, cries out the existence of God. This is something that I believe. Okay. Yeah. And the atheist may deny, I mean, the atheist does deny that creation cries out the existence of God. But my concern at this point is not with what the atheist believes. My concern is with what I believe as a Christian. And that's the first point. I believe that creation cries out the existence of God. And this leads to a second point that's related to it. Scripture also teaches me that this message of creation gets through, meaning that at some level, the Bible says, at some level, everyone knows the God who made them. And for this, I think of Romans chapter 1, where St. Paul writes about the wrath of God being revealed from heaven. And he says, against all those who suppress the truth. Well, what truth is he referring to? He goes on to say, because that which may be known about God is evident within them, for God has made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So according to St. Paul, then, and I just put these two points together, creation cries out the existence of God, and Paul says this message of creation gets through. In fact, in order to deny the message of creation, that is about God's existence, God's nature, his invisible attributes, you have to suppress the truth. That's the word that Paul uses. So what he's saying really is that the atheist, now I know any atheist listening is going to laugh at this and say it's not true,
right?
But I'm just reporting at this point. What St. Paul teaches is that the atheist is engaged in a suppression of the truth. He has dulled his knowledge. He has somehow worked to erase from his mind a message that comes through in creation, and that is that there is a God. We know who this God is. We even know what his divine attributes are from creation. And so when I sit across the table, you know, from an atheist friend or having a conversation, sitting at Starbucks with a cup of coffee, whatever it is, there are things that I know about this person. And this is what informs my apologetics. I know that this person, even though he says nothing exists but God in part, I mean, nothing exists but particles, even though he says this, I know that all of creation is crying out God's existence, and I know that at some deep level he even knows that, or he even knows the God that exists and created him, and he's suppressing that knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, well, let me throw one more point in, and then we can just talk about it a little bit. I'd like to hear what your response is to it. But the third thing is this, and this is very powerful. Scripture also teaches me that my atheist friend is himself the most eloquent argument for God's existence. Okay, my atheist friend, you and I, all of us, Christians, atheists, Buddhists, whatever, human beings, because we are the image and likeness of God. I mean, God created us to be his image, to be his likeness, if you will, to function as finite mirrors of his being. We reflect the nature of God. And therefore, you know, I mean, as rational beings, we reflect the rationality of God. As moral beings, we reflect God's moral character. In so many ways, we reflect God. Unlike any other, you know, aspect of creation, we reflect God. We're designed to reflect God. And so it turns out, just putting these together, it turns out that while the atheist denies God's existence, the atheist himself is the most eloquent, convincing argument for God's existence. In fact, I like to say that he is a walking, talking advertisement for God's existence. So I'm dealing with someone, when I deal with an atheist, I'm dealing with someone who lives in a world created by God and that reflects God and evidences God. Someone who deep within his soul, is written onto his very soul, really, is the knowledge of this God. And someone who is himself made to reflect God's character, to where, in a way, in a sense, a human being can't even look into the mirror without seeing God, can't look out at creation without seeing God, can't look into his own conscience without confronting God and his moral law and whatnot. Human beings evidence God, and the Bible goes on to teach me that every single human being seeks relationship with God, wants relationship with God. In fact, you know, St. Augustine put his finger on this when he said, "Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Catechism, in fact, of the Catholic Church, I almost fell out of my seat when I first realized this, Gary, but it actually begins with this truth. If you look at part one of the Catechism, section one, chapter one, there's a heading that says the desire for God. And this is what it says. The desire for God is written into the human heart because man is created by God and for God. God never ceases to draw man to himself. Only in God will he find the truth and happiness he never stops searching for.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's funny because that was something that I kind of almost fell off my chair too. The thought that, you know, why the church, why God is ultimately for our happiness. And that's, if someone were to ask, you know, what's your top three reasons why I should become Catholic or, you know, embrace theism or something, I don't think the average person in the pew would say for happiness, you know, but that's basically what our faith is. Our ultimate happiness, our ultimate joy is in God. That's the ultimate goal.
Well, it's because it sounds like selfishness, right? It sounds like,
yeah, right.
They owe my happiness You know, in fact, C.S. Lewis, there's a little book C.S. Lewis is called The Weight of Glory. I think it was a sermon he preached or something. Have you seen that before?
Yes.
C.S. Lewis, The Weight of Glory. Well,
right.
he begins by talking about this. On the first page of that, he says that when we talk, I mean, I'm completely paraphrasing because I haven't read it in years, but he basically says, when we talk about happiness, it sounds like selfishness. And he says, but if we feel that way, he says, we didn't get it from the Bible or from the gospel. He says, we got that idea from Immanuel Kant. He says, this idea that duty must be the highest, you know, like I should follow Christ because it's my duty to do so, that should be my highest motive. And C.S. Lewis goes on to say, he says, if we got that idea, we didn't get it from Christ, because if you read the gospels, he says, if you read the promises that are made to those who will follow in the gospels, you know, eternal life and all that, he goes, you would think that our desire for happiness is too weak, not too strong. And there's a great quotation where C.S. Lewis says, we are like children, you know, basically sitting out in the field making mud pies because we can't understand what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. Because we're far too easily pleased. Yeah, the Bible, you know, is constantly saying to us, if anyone is thirsty, come to me. You know,
Or I come that you may have life and have it more abundantly.
Yeah.
It's funny how
have, you know.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just saying, it's funny how, you know, I guess maybe it's just day to day life that we often think of the faith as, you know, a set of knowledge or like you said, duties, you know, do the good, avoid the evil, that type of stuff. But actually, the real goal is eternal life and happiness. You know, it's just, and it's funny how that kind of slips to the wayside when what you said is absolutely true.
Well, like I said, I think it's because it sounds like selfishness. I mean, if you just come out and say, oh, I'm a Christian because I want to be happy both now and for eternity. Yeah, you know, it sounds like selfishness. But again, C.S. Lewis makes the point that that doesn't really come from the gospel. So if you read the gospel, you certainly don't get the idea that the motivation of happiness is a bad motive, is a low motive, and you ought to go find some other motive, you know, that's better. But anyway.
Right. Also, St. Thomas says that God is eternally happy in and of himself, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not selfish. It's actually just joining in the happiness of God. Well, we're coming up to the break. So when we come back, why don't we talk a little bit more about these biblical points? I'm talking to Kenneth Hensley about laying down the foundation for discussions on belief. If you have a call, give us a call, 888-526-2151. And we'll be right back. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Kenneth Hensley, who... Okay, you're an honorary master apologist. How about that?
All right.
Well, remember with subsidiarity, if you're a master, that means you're the servant. So, you know, that's part of being a sensei is to serve others. But Ken, you just laid out, I think this is a really profound paper, because what you show is that from the atheist side, they realize there is this tension between their naturalist outlook, that there's nothing supernatural, and how it just doesn't square with our own self-understanding. And then you went to the Bible to show that the Bible shows that same tension, that the heavens...
Yes.
Proclaim that God exists in His glory, that that it's clear through Paul that they that this is known and suppressed, and that that the atheist himself is the most eloquent argument for God's existence. And but let me throw something at you. Now, I imagine if I were an unbeliever, I would say, well, the Bible doesn't really square with my experience, because I don't feel like I'm suppressing, you know, evidence for God. I don't feel like, you know, I'm engaging my will to dismiss God. I just think that there's no evidence for it. How would you answer that?
Well, I would try to explain the ways in which the person is suppressing. Okay. You know, as you just put it, the person says, I don't feel like I'm suppressing anything. Let me take a run at this let me back up a bit and take a run at this answer then. This is perfect. So yes, looking at scripture, looking at the teaching of the church, I have a conviction that this atheist sitting in front of me lives in a world that gives evidence of God's existence all day long. I believe that this atheist sitting in front of me actually knows the God who created him, that the evidence, as Paul says, is clear, and that to escape it entirely, he's having to suppress the evidence. I believe that he desires relationship with God, as everyone does. And I believe that he is the most eloquent, you know, argument, that he's a walking advertisement. In other words, he is himself the best and the strongest evidence. And therefore, I have to conclude, if he's an atheist, that he's living in some kind of a tension, mm-hmm. that what he says is true of the world doesn't match who he is even in the world. And so an illustration that I like to give, and then I'll apply it.
Okay.
Is of imagine a scientist who teaches that gravity doesn't exist.
Okay,
and he's a very famous scientist. He travels the world giving lectures and writing books, and the substance of his message is there is no such thing as gravity, or, and don't get technical on me, or something like gravity, if not gravity. Okay, gravity doesn't exist. That's his message, and yet because gravity does exist, he's forced to contradict himself. So when he walks out on the podium, he walks out to the podium, every time his right foot hits the surface of the stage, and every time his left foot hits the surface of the stage, he's contradicting his message. Hmm. Now, he says there's no gravity, but he contradicts it all day long. And the fact that he doesn't bother to, you know, glue his notes to the top of the podium when he preaches shows that he knows that gravity exists. I mean, the fact that he doesn't chain himself to the floor gives evidence. You know, in other words, if he really was to try to live in a manner consistent with what he says is true, you know, you just, you know, stepping out of the open door of an airplane or whatever, stepping off, you know, skyscrapers like Superman, the reality of the tension in which he's become living would that he's been living in would become evident right away. Okay. Yeah. And so my point is that the atheist is living in this tension. And if the person says, what do you mean? I don't think I'm suppressing anything. Well, then you can begin to give, you know, illustrations. For instance, well, your worldview tells you that right and wrong don't exist. Nothing exists but particles. So there is no such thing as a moral law that's just sort of floating out there, you know, along with the law of gravity, along with other physical and chemical laws. There's just this moral law that's floating out in an atheist universe, okay? No one believes that. They don't believe that. And yet, you live all day long as though right and wrong were real things.
Okay.
You talk as though right and wrong were real. I'm thinking now of the beginning pages of C.S. Lewis's famous book, Mere Christianity, where he says, all you have to do is listen to conversations of people when they say, hey, that's not fair. You know, I didn't lie to you. Why are you lying to me? Or, you know what? I gave you a piece of my orange. Why don't you give me a piece of yours? All you have to do is listen to human beings talking all day long to recognize that we believe in the existence of something called right and wrong. And surely this atheist friend believes in it, too. He may say that right and wrong don't exist. But if I, you know, if I break into his car and steal his stereo, you know, he's up in arms immediately that what I've done is wrong.
Right.
You know, he doesn't say, well, you've just done something that I don't appreciate. He thinks it's wrong. And so there's an example of the tension, and there are many, many more, but there's one example. And so what I do in apologetics, really, or in conversation with an atheist, is the way I describe it is the apologetics of remembering. And that is that I think that he knows in his heart of hearts that right and wrong exist. He knows that. And yet he holds a worldview that insists that right and wrong cannot exist. And therefore, what I'm hoping to do by giving him illustrations or talking about, you know, like the illustration of the stereo being stolen or whatever, is I'm trying to get him to remember what he really knows to be true and to see that there is a real tension in his life. If he wants to be a consistent atheist, he needs to give up on right and wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
In an atheist worldview, I mean, in a purely naturalist worldview, right and wrong must reduce to whatever we happen to like or dislike. It's just a matter of taste.
Yeah.
And yet he can't live that way. He doesn't live that way.
Do you think that's conscious? Or, you know, let me tell you, share my experience is that I often find that they kind of flip back and forth, you know, from, you know, a more theistic worldview to an atheistic worldview. You know, usually in practical matters, it's theistic. But when you push them, you know, they're the atheistic. Do you think that's conscious, or how is it that they can live like with one foot in each world?
No, I don't think that it's conscious. I mean, I'm not going to say that no atheist gets to the point where they're completely conscious of this. I think it's I think it's mainly unconscious. I mean, I think about Richard Dawkins. He's probably the most famous popular atheist on the planet. He wrote his book, The God Delusion, and other books, whatnot. But in one of his early books, he states flat out that we live in a universe in which there is no right and wrong. In fact, I wish I could quote it off the top of my head, but it's like there's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no morality. It's a universe of pitiless indifference. But then, you know, he's up in arms continually about things that he thinks are wrong about the Christian faith or wrong about religion and the harm that it does and whatnot. So, no, I don't think that it's usually conscious. I think that it's unconscious, which kind of makes sense to me because here's a man who is the image and likeness of God, who has God's law etched into his soul, who knows at the deepest level the God who created him. And yet who has come to an intellectual position which completely contradicts that and says that there's no God at all, that nothing exists but particles, you know, that I'm nothing but a biochemical machine just walking around. Everything that happens inside of me and my brain, everything that happens is just, electrochemical processes, neurons firing, whatnot. You know, so he holds a position that intellectually completely contradicts. Well, I like the way you said it, Gary. You said that when it comes to practical matters, he's kind of a theist. You know, that's a good way of saying it. On the theoretical level, oh yeah, there's no God. On the practical level, living as though there is a God.
Yeah, and that's true for believers too. I mean, we have this same kind of incoherence where you go to church on Sunday, right, and you adhere to the truths of the faith that we're all made in the image and likeness of God. Then the second you get to the church parking lot, you know, all bets are off. You have people cutting in front of each other and living like, you know, as if God didn't exist and that these were all arbitrary.
Well, I think that's a really good point. I totally agree. I mean, this is part of the human condition, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
part of the human condition to not be, you know, consistent. And, yeah, you're right. You know, go out to the parking lot and suddenly you're just driving over the old lady's toes. You know? The lady
yeah.
you're just singing in the choir with.
Yeah, so if there's any non-believers listening to this, we're not picking on you. You know, it is kind of part of the human condition where we enjoy being...
That's a good point, though.
I'm
sorry for overlapping. I was just going to say that I think that you bring up such a good point, though, that I'm not saying that people are purposely and consciously contradicting themselves or lying. And another thing I'm not saying, you know, when it comes to the moral issue, for instance, I'm not saying that atheists are not good people or that atheists don't want to live good, strong, moral lives. And many of them do. I'm sure there are atheists walking around that are more moral than I am. I'm sure there are. So the point I'm making is not that they're not moral. The point I'm making is that being moral and believing in morality contradicts their worldview.
Yeah.
They can't account for moral law on the basis of their worldview. On the basis of what they say is true of the universe, they can't account for moral absolutes, for moral law, for right and wrong having any true existence. We can, as Christians, we can account for that. We say that moral law reflects the moral character of the God who created the universe. The one who created the universe is a moral being, and moral law reflects his moral character, his moral being. The atheist says nothing exists but particles and then wants to say that right and wrong also exist.
Right. Yeah, very
That's
good.
That's the issue.
Very good. Wow, I can't believe our time has flown. Ken, how can people get a hold of your material?
Oh, well, you mentioned recorded talks at the beginning. If
yes.
they want to go to KennethHensley.com, there is a website there. I don't really do anything with the website, but that's where my recorded talks are on the store page. They can download MP3 files, you know, very inexpensively of all the recorded talks that I've done. As far as writing, they should go to chnetwork.org, and my stuff's on the blog page. You just have to search by my name. And, you know, I've been on the Journey Home show 3 times, too, so you can search and find different things that I've done there.
Okay, great. Excellent. And pick up Ken's book and Patrick Madrid's book, The Godless Delusion, as well. Great book. Thank you, Ken, for coming on Hands-On Apologetics.
So are we going to get back together in another month and move forward with this same series?
Absolutely. Yeah, I look forward to it. All right.
Okay, great.
Ken Hensley, great stuff. And please avail yourself of his works and recordings. Coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. And coming up in tomorrow's program, the blue-collar apologist John Martinoni joins us. So it's going to be lots of fun here in the dojo. And it's time for me to turn off the lights here at the Midwest Command Center. And I want to thank everybody for listening. It's great to have you aboard. And I wish everybody has a great day. And I will talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.